Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Chico author Judy Lauren Grace has written three memoirs and a novel. Later in the hour, I will ask her about her novel, Meadowlark. But first, we get to know a teenage Judy through her memoir, The Third Floor. Also, humorist and best-selling author David Sedaris offers up a sample of his sardonic wit. Chico businesswoman and hairdresser Judy Lauren Grace arrived in Chico in her Volkswagen Bug when she was 18 years old. 44 years later, she is co-owner with her daughter of Satori Color and Hair Design in Chico. It took her 23 years to write the story of what happened to her in the summer of 1962. In her book, she writes, "This is a journey of lost innocence, embarrassment, hope, and ultimately the realization that a veil of shame has been lightly draped over my being and has been there for most of my life. It could have happened to anyone." The title of her memoir is The Third Floor. Judy Lauren, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You write in your book that you grew up in the 1950s in Porterville, California. And it sounds like that up until the time you were at 15, your life was pretty typical, even ordinary.
Ordinary and easy and innocent.
Well, for people who weren't around in the early 60s, you make it clear that we didn't really know a lot then about the facts of life.
We knew nothing. There was no way to get any information.
Well, you would think that, well, your mother sits you down, Judy, and says, "Judy, we need to have a little talk." Did that happen?
Never.
And so the roles, gender roles were very clear in those days. Women had their roles, and you saw what your mother's role was in the household, and your father had his role. It was very clear. But when you got to be 15 and you started, well, you were dating, and as I mentioned, we didn't really know much about life. In fact, the information that was passed along was not always very helpful. I remember one of the quotes in your book that I thought was hilarious. And this is for young girls, information about young girls if they have cramps.
It says, "The only movie I saw about life cycles and changes was in fifth grade. I skipped home and never gave it another thought. I did remember the movie's byline. If you have cramps, always fix your hair and put on a nice dress."
Well, you know, when I read that, at first I thought it was hilarious. Mm-hmm. And reading your book made me want to talk to a friend that I grew up with, because we went through these times, our early teenage years together, and we were always comparing notes. And so I read her that line from your book, "If you have cramps, always fix your hair and put on a nice dress." And the two of us over the telephone must have laughed for a good 3 minutes about that.
Right. I was in my late 20s before I actually questioned it and said, why?
Well, it didn't help the cramps.
No.
Well, I mentioned you were dating, and you were on the swim team.
I was on the swim team, yes.
And how did that play a role in what you found out about yourself?
Well, I missed several swim meets because of unannounced menstrual cycles. I wasn't regular. I never knew when it would happen. And we had had an encounter in December, and I didn't know.
We meaning you and a young man.
The boy I was dating, and I didn't know that could lead to pregnancy. And I knew I couldn't be pregnant because you don't bleed when you're pregnant. At least that's what we girls used to think. So my mother took me to the doctor, because I had put on a little weight and was throwing up every morning. But I just thought, you know, didn't feel good.
So you find out when you do go to the doctor.
Yes.
And the doctor wasn't a very sympathetic doctor.
No. She was irritated with me for being so naive.
And I get the impression that she thought you were just not admitting the truth of the matter. And you were
right.
Pretending you didn't know.
Correct.
And she tells you you're 5 months pregnant.
And I obviously should know that. And that was the end of that appointment.
So you leave her office, mm-hmm. And now what in the world are you going to do? How's your father going to take this?
Well, I had to tell my family one by one. I locked myself in the bathroom, and my mother and my sister are knocking on the door, and then I knew my father was on his way home.
And why would your father in particular be upset? Because, I mean, most fathers would be in this situation, but your father had political aspirations in your little town of Porterville.
He did. He was the agricultural commissioner, and he was also running for mayor.
So yes. The last thing he needs is a daughter to get herself. Now, today, this wouldn't be, I mean, it might be a small ripple, but I don't think people realize in the early 1960s, this was just not
acceptable.
Very unacceptable.
We had to wear wedding rings, no matter what. To go outside to the store or to get the newspaper, you had to have a wedding ring on.
If you were pregnant, you had to have a wedding ring on.
Yes.
So what does your father do then when he finds out that you're pregnant? He obviously wants to know who's the father of this child.
Well, I write in the book, it's D-Day. My father calls me into the living room to face Tom. I hop up and rip the rollers out of my hair and tousle it with my fingers, smear Vaseline on my lips. I want to look good when I watch my father in action. He's Perry Mason if he wants to be. I walk down the hall when I realize I'm wearing my mother's pink floral nightgown. She's 4'11", I'm 5'9". I step into the living room in slow motion, sit down on the brown tweed couch positioned next to the hallway door and wall heater. Directly behind the couch is a large picture of Jesus praying on the mount. I drop to the couch before I faint, tug on the hem of my mother's nightgown. It's no use. I can still feel the night air on my legs.
So your father has called in the young man, the guilty party, whose name is Tom.
Yes. I look across the room and I see two males and my father. I don't know why Tom would bring a friend. It's too private. Mike's face is red. I'm sure mine is pink from embarrassment or red from lack of blood flow. My father looks toward me with his piercing blue eyes and he says, whoops. My heart beats out of my chest. The next scene is more shocking than I ever dreamed, and I have a vivid imagination. My father looks at me and says, Judy, both of these boys said either one of them could be your father of your child. Is this true? My heart pounds so loud I can't hear. I'm having an out-of-body experience. I hear the question seconds before the thumping begins. The room starts to spin. Part of my brain comes to my rescue. I quickly regain my composure, look toward my father, look him straight in the eye, in a clear and direct voice, I answer, no. Then go to your room. I run down the hall, jump into bed, and pull the sheets up to my chin. I hear his speech. Judy is only 15 years old. Mike, you are 19, and Tom, you are 20. I'll have both of you thrown in jail for statutory rape. Mike responds with, well, sir, I'm leaving for the Navy on Tuesday. My father shoots back. Mike, I was a Navy man for 9 years. I'll notify the Navy and you'll be tossed in the brig for a very long time. And no sounds from Tom. I wish my friend Joni was here. She will die.
So you, by the way, I want to remind listeners that my guest is Judy Lauren Grace. She's reading from her memoir, The Third Floor. And when her father finds out that she's going to be having a baby and she's only 15, in those days, in 1962, there was one option, and that is get this girl married as quickly as possible. And so he wants you to marry this young man, Tom.
Shotgun wedding or home for unwed mothers.
Well, but Tom doesn't want to take all the blame. He figures if he can bring a friend in and pretend that, well, maybe it's not me, Mr. Lauren, mm-hmm. It could be this other man. So you can't be blaming me. So what happened then?
The boys left, and about 1:45 in the morning, I hear a light knock on the door. It was Mike returning to tell my father he was helping his friend out of a jam, but he couldn't go through with it. He said early in the day he got a call from Tom saying, Judy is pregnant. I need your help. He asked Mike to tell my dad that he might be the father too. If Mike did this, he wouldn't get into any trouble. It's a boys' club code blue. Mike is a good friend to everyone, and he did that for his friend Tom.
And later on, from what you say about Mike, he really is a nice guy.
Very nice guy. He told me years later he had sat down in his car for 2 hours thinking, well, maybe I should marry Judy, and then she wouldn't get into trouble. And
yeah, he really considered doing that out of consideration for the plight that you were in, that he would marry you even though he wasn't the father of this baby.
Right.
Yeah, so he is a nice guy.
Well, the next day, My sister Bobby shows up with meds to help me terminate this pregnancy.
Well, we might mention that Bobby is an older sister, and older sisters just know more. Mm-hmm. They are more worldly. So you put your faith in this knowledge that your sister knows what she's talking about, and she comes to your rescue.
She worked in a mental hospital, so she thought she was a nurse.
That makes her a nurse then, right? And she's 6 years older, isn't she?
She's six years older, yeah.
So your older sister is going to come to your rescue by bringing some, and you put in your book, in quotes, some meds.
Yes.
So she arrives, and what does she say?
Although she's never done anything like this before, she acts like she's a doctor. Bobby asks Mom to help us. Mother closes her Bible and walks over. Mother takes a long wooden spoon and begins to stir the castor oil with the orange juice, as Bobby instructs. After stirring, she is unable to get a blend. She gives up, hands the oily spoon to my sister, and lets her stir for a while. The oil won't blend, and the orange juice continues to separate and bubble to the top. Slowly, she mixes and asks for Mom's help. The spoon goes back and forth.
So this is your sister's answer, to give you this concoction of castor oil and orange juice, that this is going to do the trick.
And quinine tablets.
And quinine tablets. So meanwhile, though, all the women in your family, your grandmother and your mother, everybody had consulted on this issue.
Yes, and they were all praying. But not doing anything.
And your sister is the one that's going to take action.
Okay. Right. She hands me some white pills. This is a lifesaver, and it turns out to be a combination of quinine tablets, castor oil, a surefire way to end a pregnancy. I have no idea what these pills might do, but Bobby says she's sort of a doctor, and I do what she says.
Sort of a doctor.
I'm sorry to tell. The options are minimal. It is fly in a plane with someone who doesn't like me and get married, or go to a home friend with mother's.
So that's what you're considering. That's what your options are at this
right.
point, that either you drink this concoction that your sister is mixing up, or you get on a plane and get out of town.
Right. And because I'm 5 months pregnant, she doubles the dosage.
If a little bit works when you're a little bit pregnant, then a lot will help if
exactly.
you're a lot pregnant.
We find our hula hoops and go round and round and round.
So you go out, and your sister says, well, okay, now that you've drunk this mm-hmm. this concoction, Judy, let's go out in the yard and we'll do some exercise. And the first exercise you try, okay, we'll do hula hoops. And so around you go with hula hoops.
We did hula hoops, then we ran around the block twice. And then it's plan C. She tells me to climb up the trellis and jump off the roof.
So the hula hoop, it was plan A, and that didn't seem to be enough. So you run around the block. That was plan B.
And tetherball.
So and because you are, I mean, you're only 15. I mean, at one point you were talking about that you went in and continued watching cartoons on TV.
Oh, that was when I started my period. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what it was, so I just sat on my sister's towels from her hope chest and watched Casper the Friendly Ghost. I didn't know.
So here you are trying to end this pregnancy with your sister's help, mm-hmm. and the exercise you've done so far hasn't done the trick. So your sister is saying, okay, now plan C, Judy. Now what does she want you to do?
I climb the trellis and jump off the roof. This is what she wants me to do.
I want you to jump off the roof of your house.
I've always been afraid of heights, and this is definitely the final hour. My sister stands on the grass in the side yard and yells for me to jump. Let's get this over with. Jump.
Now, where did she get such a nut? Did she get it from movies where the woman falls down the stairs and loses the baby? There's a miscarriage because she falls down some stairs?
Probably. I yell back down to her, are you crazy? No dice. I'll be pregnant with two broken legs. She yells back, oh, just jump.
So you tell her, there you are looking down off the roof and telling your sister, you're crazy. If I jump, I'll still be pregnant yeah. and I'll just have two broken legs.
Exactly. I decide that moment to test her level of devotion and concern. So I yell back down to her, I'm too scared. I can't do it. Come up here and let's jump together and hold hands. And she yells, no, I don't want to hurt myself. I have to work tomorrow.
So she's telling you that, no, I'm not going to go up there because I've got to work tomorrow. This is serious business for me, that I'm not going to take a chance on that.
I ran into the house. I felt sick, and so I ran to the bathroom, and my sister, her abortion clinic was closed, and I wanted to strangle her.
So your sister has all these grand ideas of how to end the pregnancy. None of them work. And so the result is you're in your same predicament, but you're mad at your sister.
I'm mad at my sister, and she comes over the next day and just as happily tells me she's sewing smocks.
Her life is going on as usual.
Exactly.
And yours is in turmoil.
Yes.
My guest is Judy Lauren Grace, and her memoir is The Third Floor. She's telling us what happened in the summer of 1962. When she finds herself 5 months pregnant, she didn't know she was pregnant until she got this diagnosis of being 5 months pregnant. And after you decide, well, we can't end the pregnancy and Tom is not going to marry you. So the third choice, and in those days, this was really what women did. I mean, you had to make up some excuse mm-hmm. and off you went to a home for unwed mothers. And I think it's interesting we call this a home for unwed mothers, because this place you went was not very homey.
Not at all.
So where was this place that you...
It was in Oakland.
And what did your friends, because you did tell your best friend Joni,
yes.
you told her what really was the situation.
Yes.
But other people who weren't on a need-to-know basis were told you were going to the World's Fair in Seattle.
Yeah.
And I thought that was funny because you're going to be spending 4 months at
the
World's Fair.
Well, I thought it was just so clever of me to say that. And then once I got up there in the home and everyone had their story on what they were doing, I said, well, I'm going to have to explain while I was at the World's Fair for 4 months.
So that the World's Fair was your idea to say, well, just tell
yeah.
people I'm at the World's Fair.
I thought it was clever. I didn't find out until I wrote this book that our band was up there that year. And like four of my friends were up there.
In Seattle.
Yes.
So off you go. You're driving to this home for unwed mothers. And you describe these steps. In fact, the cover of your book shows a young girl walking up steps and holding onto a handrail. Mm-hmm. And you say when you arrive at this home and you check in, and how welcome did you feel when you got to this home?
It was eerily quiet. The floor was polished to a high gloss, and there were no people, no girls. So that scared me. My parents left. We hugged each other, and I write, I'm in a sleepwalking trance as I walk along the hallway. I hold on to my family's suitcase, which brings me comfort and security. She and I move along the corridor, me and the woman from behind the glass window. She tells me to address her as Lieutenant. It's my first red flag. Our soft steps take us closer to my summer home. Quietly we walk, me and the Lieutenant. When we reach room 4, she hands me the rules of the home and a key for my narrow closet. She introduces me as Judy G and leaves.
So you can't, the girls there don't give their last names, just the first name and last initial.
Right.
So you arrive and this woman tells you, call me Lieutenant.
Yes.
Did you know that this was run by the Salvation Army? I guess you did know that.
Did know that.
So the Salvation Army has this, it's really a hospital because you're gonna have your baby there.
Right. There's
on the third floor.
On the third floor. We went upstairs and had our babies, and the babies went out the front door, the girls out the back door. Mm-hmm. And we never talked to the girls once they went upstairs. So once again, we have no idea what labor and delivery actually means.
Because you never got to talk to the girls once they had their babies.
Right.
They were gone.
Right.
My guest is Judy Lauren Grace, and her book is The Third Floor. And this refers to the third floor of a home for unwed mothers in Oakland. So there was a lot of adjustment. First of all, your parents leave you. You're there by yourself. You had grown up in a rural community, and here you were in an inner city. And so what are your roommates like? Are they city girls or are they rural?
Well, I write because it's in the 60s. I had two colored roommates and a white room girl that I roomed with. And we got to know each other, and all I saw were the color of their skin. But within a day or two, one of my roommates and I became very close.
Well, when I was reading parts of your book to my husband, and when you go in and you say that you had two colored girls mm-hmm. as your roommates, he said, "Colored girls? That we don't say that." And I said, "No, they did. This was 1962, mm-hmm. and that's what the term was in 1962." Mm-hmm. So you find that you have a really close friendship with one of the colored girls.
We are inseparable. We get along really well. I found that I was clinging to her friendship because she was 17, I was 15, and she seemed to be more accepting of the situation. She was just going to do her time and then go back home.
She was a little bit older, and she also was accustomed to being in a city more than you were.
She just lived a mile down the road or down the street, but she didn't know, none of her family knew where she was. They thought she was at secretarial school for the summer.
So that was her cover story.
Right. That was her cover story. And she was actually in her own turf. So she was... Mm-hmm.
She was more comfortable than you were all the way around.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So her name was Beth, you say, in the story.
Yes.
And you and Beth... and you didn't just sit around. I mean, you had your tasks to do
there.
We had
our daily chores. She had to clean the smoking room. She didn't smoke, but she had to go in there twice a day and clean magazines and ashtrays and all that stuff, you know, you get when people sit around. And I had to do all kinds of things, different chores.
So you had your jobs to keep the place clean and...
I did dishes for 50 girls three times a day. That mm-hmm. was one of my chores.
So there were 50 girls there in the home.
50 girls, a waiting list to get in, and every couple of weeks it turned around. There were new girls.
Mm-hmm. As girls would have their babies mm-hmm. and they would leave.
And then we played hopscotch every day in the back.
Yeah, you mentioned that, that you were playing hopscotch.
Yeah, we'd play hopscotch where the trucks would turn around to deliver things. And then there was a deck and we'd sunbathe, pull up our smocks and try to get some color. And Beth would paint a cookie jar and ceramics. So, yeah, we kept busy.
Well, one thing that you did, which I'm sure at this point in your life you were glad you did, and that is that you wrote letters to your friend Joni.
I wrote many letters. I drew pictures of the home, of the floors. I numbered rooms. I told her everybody's name and everything that happened, and she saved all of my letters.
So when you got ready to write this book, you didn't really have to rely on a fuzzy memory of it. You had it all in your own words.
Well, but those words were from a 15-year-old, and that was embarrassing. But it did bring back a lot of memories. But actually writing it, they would come back to me. It was shocking that I had totally blanked out some of the things that came back to me 48 years later.
And you had it right there in your own writing, so you knew that this had happened. So Joni, your friend Joni, saved these letters for you.
Yes.
And, you also have photographs in your book. And those of us who were in high school at that mm-hmm. time recognize those hairdos. Joni had huge hair because that's the way you wore your hair then.
Big, big hair, pink frosted lip gloss. Yeah.
And speaking of pink, too, Joni's dad, and I love this little detail you included, what kind of car did Joni's dad have?
We would cruise around in his pink Edsel.
Pink Edsel. I thought that was just great. Because people now, I mean, some of us remember the Edsel car, but they only made them for a very short time.
It was just a huge tub. We couldn't pick up guys in that car.
And so Joni had this pink Edsel. And so she saved your letters. So when you wanted to write this story, you had these letters.
I had the letters.
And it was a big mystery what happened to the girls once they went to the third floor. So when your time came, it was a Friday evening, and you knew it was time for you to go up on the third floor. Mm-hmm. So you go up there. But your baby didn't come that Friday. It didn't come Saturday. It didn't come Sunday. Monday, you were still in labor.
Correct.
And you did have a very nice nurse.
Sweet, yes.
So, and a doctor that was very nice. The only thing about this doctor, he was a very nice guy, but he was paying more attention to your feet than you wanted to him to pay attention to the fact that you were trying to have a baby.
He had examined me before while I was in the home that summer, and he just loved my feet. He loved my arches, my high arches.
He admired. He just thought you had attractive arches.
Right. So when I was actually delivering the baby, I had to constantly remind myself not to arch my feet because he wouldn't pay attention.
To the fact that you wanted him to deliver this baby. Well, it was Nurse Black was her name. I remember her name because she was such a nice Mrs. Black, this nice nurse. And when she comes back on duty early Monday morning, and she says, Judy, you haven't had this baby yet. When are you going to have this baby? And you told her.
I don't know why I said it. I said 208.
And a few hours later, you had this baby, and nurse Mrs. Black says, Judy, look at the clock.
I arched my head back. I look at this big clock.
Back and, over your shoulder.
Yes, mm-hmm. over my shoulder, and it was 208.
So you couldn't have seen the clock, but you predicted the precise time
I
that
did.
Your baby would be born.
And she came in at 6 a.m., so it was hours before I had my son.
So this was a very long process, your labor. Mm-hmm. So you have the baby. You take the baby home because some girls gave up their baby right away.
Right.
And for adoption.
And they were coached not to hold their babies.
Yeah. Not to hold their babies, mm-hmm. to give the baby up right away.
Right.
You take your baby home.
Right.
But you didn't get to keep. So and when reading your story, we don't know from one moment to the next, well, is Judy going to get to keep the baby? First of all, is she going to have the baby? If your sister ideas had worked. So then when you have the baby, is she going to give it up for adoption? Is she going to keep it? So we think you're going to keep it, but then you were really tricked into giving up your baby.
I am. And to this day, I'm not 100% sure how it unfolded, but I was, yeah.
You just found yourself signing papers.
Signed papers. I was sick. I had the Asian flu. I had a high fever, and it just seemed like the only way out. My mother had had a stroke, and my parents had divorced, and it was a
kaleidoscope. That's another thing.
Of things.
When you're reading your story, I mean, there's one unexpected plot twist after another. Your parents get divorced, and your mother's in poor health, and when you're sick, your baby is given up for adoption, you sign the papers, and then years go by, and you wonder about this baby.
Mm-hmm.
And people want to know, well, did she ever find this baby? Well, it wouldn't be a baby at the time you found him.
I did.
A little boy.
I did find him. He was 22 years old, 6 foot five.
And by then, you already had other children.
I had three other children.
And so they discover they have an older brother.
Well, I know. That was another thing. I had a 15-year-old son, and I had to fess up.
So all this came out.
Mommy wasn't a good girl there.
Well, at least in those days.
In those days, right.
And, you know, a sad thing, too, that after you discover this son, and he only lives to be 21.
No, my oldest son that I raised only lived to be 21. The son I found is still alive
still
and
alive.
Well. He's 48.
But you lost a son when he was 21.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, this is just an incredible story, Judy. And those of us who lived through that time can really appreciate the story that you have told with such humor. My guest has been Judy Lauren Grace. Her book is The Third Floor. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'm going to ask Judy Lauren Grace about her fourth book, a novel entitled Meadowlark. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is Chico author Judy Lauren Grace. After her first memoir, The Third Floor, Judy went on to write two more memoirs, Dreamscape in A Minor and Rita's Road. Judy, welcome back.
It's nice to be here.
We've just heard what happened to you when you were a teenager. You wrote this about this in The Third Floor. And then what was your second memoir about?
It was, well, the dreamscaping of minor refers to my son, Jeff, who is musically talented, and he took his life. He committed suicide when he was 21. And it's about the 24-year aftermath of how his family coped, siblings, friends. It changed everything. It's a new dynamics with our family.
And so this really happened to you. You lost your son to suicide.
Yes, and I investigated different religions, mediums, psychics. I talked to everyone, every religion I could think of, and asked, where did your soul go? I was really suffering, trying to figure out, where did this talented boy go? He just, poof, went away one day. And I felt I needed to write a book about that, the aftermath.
So this was a way of healing for you to write this second memoir.
Yes, it was very healing, and it's helped a lot of people who have lost children and parents.
I would
think
so.
I'm a mother or father or aunt, and people are getting in touch with me and really moved by this.
So I might remind people the name of that book was Dreamscape in A Minor. And then what did you write about in your second memoir? Because it looks like you would have been all written out, Judy.
Well, you'd think. It was my third. It was Rita's Road. And she was my best friend. We met when we were 13, and we had the similar personalities. We were kind of silly and crazy and witty and sarcastic. And when we just had a really great time, I just loved her. And then when she was 18, she had got an Austin Healey. We took long trips and camped in my dad's 65 Mustang all the way to Canada and back. And it's about her life. When she was 26, she was run off the road and hit her head on lava rocks, and she suffered short-term memory the rest of her life, which was another 40 years. And we continued that wonderful friendship, even though I had to answer the same question over and over and over again. But I didn't care.
So this was Rita's Road that you wrote about your friend Rita. And it is a memoir, but it's really centered around this dear friend of yours.
It's about loyalty and friendship and love. And there's a lot of humor in there because she was a comedian. And she's lost her memory, but she did not lose her wit.
And you are able, you have a talent for writing about serious subjects with humor, Judy.
Well, thank you, I guess.
Well, so this new book, this new novel, is quite a change of pace for you.
It is. I had no idea this was in my head.
And when I began reading your book, I thought, my goodness, where did this come from? Where did this idea for your new book, the title of your new book is Meadowlark. Where did that idea come from?
Well, I was taking a nap with my little doggy, and I just sound asleep, and I had this wonderful thought, and it actually opened up into a plot, and it woke me up. And I sat on the edge of the bed, and I thought, what would somebody do if they were faced with this and had a split-second decision to make? A nice person, just a normal, nice, educated person, what would you do? And I sat there and thought about it. And I laid back down and woke up and had the ending. It was just all rolling around in my head.
So it literally came to you in a dream.
Yes.
Well, let's meet the person who is telling this story, because you have a narrator and we don't know her name at first.
Right.
But I wish you would, if you would read us the prologue, Judy, to your new book, Meadowlark.
I'll read the first paragraph.
Okay.
Okay. Looking back from my perch, I close my eyes and reconstruct the day, the exact moment it all began to unfold and rear its ugly head. A split-second decision with good intentions combined with natural instincts that most humans have. This is a switch that moved my life to another realm. My simple life as I had known it began to swirl in all directions the moment I touched her.
This is Judy Lauren Grace reading from her new novel, Meadowlark. And we wonder, okay, who is the narrator? I close my eyes, it says. And then we meet some other person we don't know. The moment I touched her. And the narrator goes on to say, this new existence I now live is contrary to how I was raised and erupts into a constant battle inside my head that cautions me about right and wrong. So here's this person, this narrator, who is struggling with what is right and what is wrong. She says, a life I never imagined is laid out before me. The unexpected left turn began the day I stepped out of the shadows from the safety of my front porch and met head-on a world of drugs and violence and evil. My goodness, all in one sentence. Here's this person who seems quite normal, and all of a sudden, she's in a world of drugs and violence and evil?
Yes. She's just minding her own business. She had suffered the loss of her husband and was grieving in her own way and trying to just figure out which way to go in her life. And then this situation was presented, and she did, I think, what anybody would have done. I couldn't say that for every person, but it, for her, it was what she needed.
The right thing to do.
It was the right thing.
In her mind, yeah. You said, blending in with the walls has always been my refuge. It's a comfortable and secure place to live. At least I thought it was, until I realized how the old tapes in my head still run freely and play. Ignorance is bliss. I was taught to color inside the lines, never talk back, and to be gracious under all circumstances. These subliminal messages from childhood play back in my mind throughout the day. Remember, child, stay in the shadows, be seen and not heard, and always glide through life unnoticed and detached. That's the safest route. And I think a lot of people could say this.
Absolutely.
That you stay in the shadows. A child should be seen and not heard. I mean, I grew up being taught that.
Most of us were.
And so, and was that how you were brought up also?
Absolutely. And so I guess as I narrate for her, a little me is in there, obviously.
That's what I was thinking. So this is our narrator, but it sounds like it's a little bit of yourself.
I was trying to camouflage myself because she's short and has long, thick, dark hair and curly hair, and I'm tall and thin, and I thought no one will recognize me in this book.
So you physically disguise yourself.
Yes.
But we read between the lines and say, that sounds like Judy.
That's
Would you like to read that first paragraph in chapter one, Judy, when you start out? You're still the narrator. This is on page three.
Oh, you're on page three. I'm way over here. Naturally, I did what all girls, good girls do. After college, I married my one and only sweetheart, Jim. We bought a vintage house and had it restored to our liking. Our first home sits on a grassy knoll with a huge maple trees surrounding the property. Like most young couples, we get a dog, a sweet golden retriever named Izzy. I stand 5'1", and I'm always described as short in nature and stature. Most people talk over my head as if I'm a child. Jim's family is concerned that we will produce short, stocky sons. I resent this accusation, but never let on that I think they're a bunch of shallow, bunch of bigots. I have black hair, green eyes, and a dimple in my chin. And then I just go on to describe myself, which is totally opposite of what I look like.
Because I might remind
myself.
People, this is Judy Lauren Grace reading from a novel. The novel is entitled Meadowlark. And this is not her speaking when she's saying, this is the narrator of her story. And she says she deliberately describes this person physically as not being like Judy herself. And in fact, your character says, I wish I had a few more inches height and not such a plain Jane face. I've worn my hair in a fluffy bubble since third grade. And he said, and with that came the responsibility and daily chore of keeping it nice and tidy because moist weather makes it appear to be a curly tossed salad. Now, when you're describing your hair, you know what? My thoughts go back to the fact that you really know what you're talking about when you talk about hair, Judy.
I do. There's a lot of hair remarks throughout. And this person throughout my book gets a little more sprinkles of gray and more. And yeah, I couldn't help myself. I had to describe hair.
I thought that was appropriate, Judy, actually.
Do you want me to set up?
happened? So from the start of chapter one, this sounds like such a normal person. She marries the man she loves, and they have a house and a dog and everything that you would expect just some normal person's life would be.
Well, she certainly didn't expect him to fall out of a wingback chair and die right there in her arms. And that sort of jolted her. And she only has one child who's away at college, so...
So this idyllic life that she is living comes to a screeching halt.
Yes. And she's just trying to figure it out and be stoic, which isn't working very well. And there's a baby down the street who screams every night and wails of pain. And it keeps her awake and she can hear it. And she's stewing over this and worried. And finally, when her daughter comes up to visit and have a wonderful...
Now, when you say come up to visit, where is your narrator living?
Our narrator lives in Northern California, Dunsmuir.
Dunsmuir. Yeah.
Yes.
So I was interested in how you chose Dunsmuir for her to live.
Well, my son and daughter-in-law live up there and have jobs and teach, and we go up there all the time.
So this is familiar territory for you, Dunsmuir.
Yes, yes.
So you have your character. Your narrator lives in Dunsmuir.
Yes.
Her daughter comes up to visit, and they both hear this child
screaming. It's not like, I don't want to go to bed. Where's my teddy bear? I'm hungry. It was torture, screaming torture.
And when you were dreaming this, did you hear in your, when you were coming up with this idea for this book, did you hear a child's screams?
No. I just have.
Those are details that came later.
Yes. I just dreamed it. And then when I was writing this, I sat down and just started typing. I did take a typing class in high school, and I don't have to look at these fingers. And they just took off.
So your fingers were typing out this story.
Yes, and I that's when I entered the child, the toddler, and her daughter comes up from San Luis Obispo and expects to have a wonderful Christmas with her mom and snow ski. And the mom likes to go up there with her and have a bowl of chili and watch her come down the slope traversing and join her. But instead, they hear the baby, and the two of them decide to take a walk around the block. And there she is, this little toddler's looking out a window. There's no glass, and it's freezing cold. And she is almost naked, and she just stares like a mannequin. She said later to her daughter, did you see the toddler in the window? It's haunting. And her daughter said, no, but the guy that lives there was frightening. And there's a chapter about in detail what they did and how they walked away and pretended like, oh, we just saw your car and we love it. My uncle had a car just like that. And trying to get back home because they were scared to death, just the feeling of that house.
Well, your character, is like any sensitive person would feel terrible knowing this child was suffering right there in her neighborhood. And
no one did anything.
Nobody was doing anything.
She was wondering, do other people hear this baby at night? And she realized most of these houses up here are summer getaways. And a lot of the times they probably don't hear the child or they don't want to be bothered.
But this woman is bothered. And this child who's in pain bothers her. And so what happens?
It says, the next time I hear the baby wail in pain, the mother bear comes out in me and I prepare for a full-on charge. Every cell in my body is on high alert. The cries are due to torture and continue to pull me towards my natural instincts. I know I must do the right thing. This is the moment I realize I must shed my exterior unemotional veneer and reach deep into my soul and stop this madness. The screams and the cries continue, and the pitiful sounds seem to fly down the street and into my yard. I am getting up my nerve to interact and call the authorities. One night, after it quiets down, I step outside onto my front porch. I thought I heard something hit the side of the house. I stand and stare down the street in each direction and look. I wonder if my other neighbors hear. How many of us listen and do nothing? I then realize, that's when I realize they're second homes. My neighbors are all part-time residents as the locals call them, fair-weather neighbors. Then I see it, the amber glow of his cigarette. He's been watching me from the shadows from a clump of pines on the corner. Immediately, my body reacts with cold chills that race up my spine and the hair on my back stands on end. I am frightened and in slow motion take the sashes and pull my robe in nice and tight around my waist, making a knot to match the one in my stomach. He's holding a stick and he begins to smack it into the palm of his hand. He steps out to expose himself as a spineless wimp and begins to yell from his pine hideout. "You seen my kid?" he demands. I choke out, "No, I haven't." He smacks his palm a few times and yells in his loud, smoky, angry voice, "Girl, you better come out. Girl, girl, I said girl." He walks away and I can hear him down the street and around the corner yelling as he swats his palm.
Well, we hear this this story, and I think any person with a heart would be touched by the way your character is. By the way, we eventually learn that the narrator is named Nettie.
Nettie, yes.
And that she is so upset by this that she feels she has got to do something. The right thing to do is to take some action. But yet the action she takes in the eyes of the law are not the right thing to do.
Exactly.
What does she do?
I carefully move to the edge of the porch to see which way he went. I hear the continuous swats on the palm of his hand in the distance. I hope he continues to walk into the night and tumble right off a cliff. To make sure he's still walking, I step down one step when I spot something. A slow movement out of the corner of my eye, very slight shuffle. I wonder if the wind blew a kid's soccer ball under my tree. The cold night air moves it in the wind. I squat to look under the rail and closely, squinting my eyes, decides it's a patterned ball of tan and black. From the shelter of my front porch, I gingerly step out into the fresh light blanket of snow and look both ways for signs of the angry man. I step into the lawn and make my way to the edge of the house. My curiosity has the best of me and I takes over logic. I hope this is not a trap. Then, curled up, I recognize it is a small child. It's not a ball. It's her rump moving in the night to keep her hidden and to stay warm. The pattern I see as I take a closer look is the dirt on her little diaper and a long-sleeved shirt. I scoop her up into my arms, and she crawls inside my robe for warmth and shelter. Her legs wrap around my hips, and her arms hide their way inside and snuggle in a tight fold between our bodies.
Okay. My guest is Judy Lauren Grace, and she is reading from a novel, Meadowlark. And so far, nothing you have said, Judy, implies anything about a bird. So why did you call your book Meadowlark?
Good question, Nancy. A meadowlark has a beautiful song. Many people love the meadowlark. It's her favorite bird because of the song. But they also hide in tall grasses, and they're hard to see. And this is going to be her life. She's going to take that child, keep that child, and reinvent herself and hide.
Well, you'd think that there would be on TV or radio announcements, there's a missing child, and there was nothing.
After 5 days, she noticed there's been nothing on the radio. No one's doing anything. There's nobody driving by, no one looking. And the toddler has no inclination to look out the window. She just wants to be held and rocked and fed warm oatmeal.
So years go by, and this young toddler grows up and is calling this person that's taking care of her Nettie.
Yes.
But there comes a point when she calls her grandma.
She does. The daughter comes back up and they see
her biological daughter.
Yes, comes up to visit and she goes, "Well, what does she call you?" And she goes, "Nettie." And she goes, "I'm her safety net and don't you laugh." And she goes, "Okay, Nettie." And that's where they take off. The daughter is pulled into this and realizes, well, they see her scars and Nettie takes photos when she puts her to bed after she gives her a warm bath and she pulls away from the soap because of the pain. and they're just slices and scars and black and blue eyes, and they're on her arms and legs and back. And then when her daughter comes up, she shows her these.
Well, and then Nettie knows that the day is going to come when this former toddler is going to want to know, well, who are my parents? Who is my mother? Who is my father? And Nettie knows that she's going to have to tell the story. So what happens when that day comes?
Well, she ends up, she wanted to name her something that was current, and she decides to name her Jessica. And that's because this is in the early 80s when this happens. And Jessica grows up to be a high-functioning person with, she's grounded, she's everything Nettie instilled into her. And she says, Nettie, why do I have all these scars on my body? And why do you always put that goo on my scars? And she goes, you mean aloe vera? It's, we're going to heal these and we keep you out of the sun. And she says, well, what did you do? How did you get me? Will you ever tell me? You're not my real grandma. And she said, I saved you. And she goes, I thought so. And that, after that, she began to call her grandma.
Well, do you know, and I don't want to give away too much, Judy, mm-hmm. but this story reminds me of the story of Moses, because Moses' mother wants to take care of him, and the best way she can take care of him is to have him raised by somebody mm-hmm. else.
I never thought of that, Nancy, but maybe I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah, because this young child is raised by somebody who truly loves her, who raises her as her own daughter, and does everything that is in her best interest.
Exactly. She dedicated the rest of her life to her daughter and told her own biological daughter, I love you, just deal with it. Let's get through this. And so she started calling her Aunt Dana.
Well, did you, do you, in the story, we don't want to tell the readers, do you reveal who this child's actual mother and father are?
Well,
I've read the book, but then, but the readers who haven't might want to know.
When she took pictures of her wounds, she did that to someday when they came to take this child from her to show that she was saving the child. But nobody ever came back. So she has the file. And there's a chapter called The File where she wants to know everything. And so she reveals and tells her everything and shows her the photos. And that's when Jessica wants to find her parents and confront them. She's angry and she has a lot of questions.
Which is understandable.
Yes. And she does find out what happened and meets her biological family. Of course, she had to go to Pelican Bay Prison to find him, but she finds him.
She finds her father.
Yes.
In Pelican Bay Prison.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other threads in this story that you can reveal without giving away the surprises? Because there are some shocking turns of plot as we get deeper into the story.
Yes. A lot of people, when they post a review on Amazon, are saying a lot of twists and turns in this book. You don't think every chapter something's happening. And, of course, she meets her neighbor. They're in duplexes on rocks overlooking the ocean. And it's the beginning of a beautiful love affair.
So it has its warm, tender moments, too.
It has. Yes, it does. And he becomes a force to be reckoned with. He's what she has always needed.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you about your new book, Judy. And I wish you, you say on the cover of your book, Meadowlark, the unforeseen ramifications of a deliberate crime weave a harrowing and captivating 22-year saga.
Yes. I mean, the detectives are after her. It's hang on.
Hang on. And
hang on.
And maybe we'll hear from you again, Judy. It's been a pleasure talking to you about your new book.
Thank you for having me.
Every collection of essays by celebrated author and humorist David Sedaris has become an instant New York Times bestseller. His voice on radio and in print has become distinctive for its wit and insight into social norms and the human condition. An Evening with Sedaris may feature pieces from published manuscripts or work from future radio shows and essays yet to be published. David Sedaris will be in Lexan Auditorium on the Chico State campus next Saturday, November 12th. Here's a sample of David's talent for storytelling.
I was going to read a story here that wasn't in the book. And I think it'll be evident when I read it why it wasn't in the book. No, it's just a difference between something out loud and something on paper. And it was written for a radio show that I do things for. And they did a show called Innocence Abroad. And I think I was the only person who wrote anything from it who actually lived abroad. And I don't think that the producers understood that this is something that everyone who lives in another country has to deal with. In the last semester of my final year of college, I signed up for a class titled Art and Politics. The course catalog made it sound interesting, but once we got started, I could see that I had been misled. Part of the problem was the teacher, who was gray-haired and bearded and in his late 50s. Sobel, I think his last name was. To say that he was not a gifted public speaker would be putting it mildly. Neither did he know much about contemporary art, at least not the kind being bought and sold in New York, and that, to most of us, was the only kind that mattered. What this guy mainly knew about were murals, the sort done by poor people with spray paint. He'd drive to the west side of Chicago, photograph an underpass or the outside of a rundown school, and bring the slides to class. Then he'd project them onto the screen and proceed to talk until the darkness of the room and the dull cadence of his voice put most of my classmates to sleep. I found him as narcotic as everyone else did, but what kept me awake, and on my toes even, was the anticipation of certain words, one of them being Latino. What we see in many of these displaced Latino cultures, he'd say. He took an undeniable pride in Chicano as well. But his real showstopper, the one that made the hairs on my arm stand up, was Nicaragua. I couldn't get enough of it. At the end of every class, he'd flick on the lights, ignoring the students who yawned and stretched and shielded their eyes against the sudden brightness. Are there any questions? Yes, I'd say. In that No More U.S. Intervention mural, what country specifically do you think the artist was talking about? Well, that would most clearly be Nicaragua. Then he'd look around the room, ask if there were any further questions, and frown a little at the sight of my hand back in the air and waving. Yes, I'd say, me again, listen, this might sound beside the point, but which Central American country do you think grows the best coffee? He scratched his beard. Costa Rica? Well, who's second best then? Well, there's El Salvador. Certainly, but me personally, I would probably go with Nicaragua. Why do you ask? Just curious.
Humorist David Sedaris, who will be in Laxon Auditorium on the Chico State campus next Saturday, November 12th. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.